This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
When I heard about the new ICE decision, I felt a range of emotions. I felt angry because I was being used as a pawn, but I also felt hopeless because there was nothing I could really do about it.
That's Hanan Ali, who is studying in the U.S. from Kenya under new rule that international students will not be permitted to stay in the U.S. if their schools only offer online classes due to COVID-19. Details coming up also. Cameroon will not host the finals of the 2020 African Championship League in September because of the pandemic. Soccer fans voice disappointment. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The International Criminal Court opens a trial today against Al-Hassan Ag Abdulaziz of Mali. He is accused of crimes against humanity and war crimes during the Islamist takeover of Timbuktu and surrounding areas, and for ordering attacks against old and sacred buildings in the Malian city. Nicolas Pinon is a journalist in Paris, France, and VOA Steve Miller spoke to him via WhatsApp to get the details.
First of all, it wasn't clear if he would appear in court because of the pandemic and all the security and sanitary measures that you're going to have. So Al-Hassan appeared in court today in The Hague. He was wearing a traditional turban and also a mask to protect against the coronavirus. And he talked briefly to the prosecutor, saying that he understood the charges. The prosecutor did talk about what happened and all the crime that he was, according to the prosecutor, directly involved in Timbuktu, and especially the women and torture, especially the violence and the torture against men, women, and children. And the prosecutor had this sentence for him. Al-Hassan worked in the heart of a repressive persecuting system. So it was pretty strong word against Hassan, who barely talked. And as of right now, it's going to be a lot of procedure between the lawyers and the prosecution. And some of this discussion are going to occur privately, not in front of the camera, because, you know, most of the hearings at the ICC, they are filmed. But to protect the anonymity of some victims and some witnesses in this case, it's going to be behind closed doors.
Nico, with some of the hearings not taking place in front of the cameras, what can we expect next in terms of the case going forward?
Well, basically, they're going to have to, the prosecution is going to have to make the case that he was personally involved in supervising the destruction of the cultural sites in Timbuktu, and also that he was leading the religious police in Timbuktu. Al-Hassan was allegedly the head of 40 men who basically were sentencing people according to their religious interpretation of the Quran. And he, you know, obviously targeted people like men, women, and children, and also mutilate them when, according to him, they were not respecting the obviously the religious law. And also, I think that's something that's very interesting, is that that's not the first case in front of the ICC. Back in 2017, you have also one member of this group, Ansardin, who was sentenced to 7 years in prison. His name was Ahmad Al-Faqih Al-Ahmadi, and that's very similar. And back in the days, 2 years ago, the ICC said that you had this obviously difficult pain and trauma that was imposed on local population because of this group. So you're going to have this similar line of defense. Al-Hassan lawyer saying that, you know, he was not really involved. They're going to try to really lower the expectation, and they're going to try to really say that he was not a leader. But according to witnesses and according to what we know back in the days when Ansardin, one of the terrorist group, was ruling Timbuktu in northern Mali, we know that they imposed their law, the Sharia, according to them. And it was very harsh for the population. Many years after, local population, they still suffer from kind of PTSD because of what happened. And also, it's important to mention that the sites in Timbuktu have been rebuilt. over the past few years, but nothing has been the same because of the insecurity in the region.
That was reporter Nicolas Pinault speaking to VOA's Steve Miller from Paris. The proceedings are occurring against the backdrop of continuing jihadist attacks in Mali and violent protests against the president for being unable to stop them. Political opponents who were detained during 3 days of protests were freed yesterday. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, has announced a new rule that international students will not be permitted to stay in the U.S. if their schools offer only online classes rather than in-person teaching due to the COVID-19 crisis and the fall semester. Journalist Ais Kalisi in New York talked to international students who may be affected by the new rule.
Both universities and foreign students have been critical of the decision to bar international students holding F1 and M1 visas from coming to the U.S. if their schools offer only online classes when the school term begins in the coming weeks. ICE said international students must take at least some courses in person to enter the country. If they stay while taking a full course load online, they might face deportation. This ruling comes as the number of novel coronavirus cases is rising in the country, and almost all U.S. schools have operated entirely with online instruction since March. The Chronicle of Higher Education, which tracks coronavirus planning, says there are about 1 million foreign students in the country, and it says about 100 universities and colleges, out of more than 1,000, plan to primarily offer online classes in the coming term, including Harvard University and University of California system. Hanan Ali is a rising senior at the University of Toledo in Ohio who came to study in the U.S. from Kenya. She's concerned about her graduation being pushed back.
When I heard about the new ICE decision, I felt a range of emotions. I felt angry because I was being used as a pawn, but I also felt hopeless because there was nothing I could really do about it.
Students all over U.S. have been signing petitions and demanding their colleges to accommodate international students. Nicola Gu from Nigeria is majoring in international business and accounting at the College of Staten Island in New York. She has been working with the City University of New York's Student Senate to get voices of the international students heard. Agu says the new ICE policy does not benefit anyone.
ICE had zero empathy and consideration over what these students are already going through. This new policy is disrupting their lives and educational plans.
The acting head of U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Ken Cuccinelli, said in an interview on the CNN television network, the new rule will encourage universities to fully open in the fall. And he said it was more lenient than the previous policy, which limited foreign students to taking only one online course each semester, though that rule temporarily was waived once schools switched to online-only classes in March. U.S. President Donald Trump has been pushing for schools to open in the fall. For students who return to their home countries for summer holiday, this new policy throws into doubt whether they will come back to the U.S. when the classes resume. Andrea Cuadros, a Peruvian student attending SUNY Plattsburgh in New York, says she's not entirely comfortable returning to the U.S. due to travel restrictions in her home country. She also has asthma, making her highly vulnerable to COVID-19. However, she's afraid of losing her student visa if she does not return to school.
I feel now more than ever like an outsider. And it's if my student rights and professional future come in second place to everything else. We've been forced to abandon not only our studies, but our homes too. Most of us are stuck in countries like travel restrictions like my own. And I still have no clue of how to get back on time to campus for classes while worrying about not getting infected in the journey.
Another student, Laman Hanfeyeva, is at home in Azerbaijan since the spring semester became online. She says she felt helpless when she read ICE's announcement.
I felt like the U.S. was simply against me. It is a huge risk to travel right now, but we internationals have always made huge sacrifices and had to figure out a way. And that's what I will be doing now, just like most of my friends.
Many universities have condemned the ICE decision. Harvard University and Massachusetts Institute of Technology have filed a lawsuit against blocking the visa decision, and the University of California system plans to do so. For Voice of America News, this is Aisha Kaja from New York.
In South Africa, police report that 31 farms were attacked and 4 farmers murdered in less than 2 weeks after the country's COVID-19 hard lockdown ended. Police say that's a highly unusual figure for such a short time. Most of the victims were white. Opposition parties say the statistics are evidence of organized crime and are not normal criminality, as the government has described it. Darren Taylor reports.
During the COVID-19 lockdown, the state withdrew police squads that it had sent to some rural areas to help farmers. A member of Parliament's Intelligence Committee, Diane Kohler-Barnard, says the cooperation was quite successful in preventing farm attacks.
Will those mechanisms be switched back on successfully post-COVID? These are run by volunteers with zero budget, and they go to and report back to the police from areas the police just don't have the manpower or the vehicles to patrol.
Rather than spending money on supplies that could boost food production, says Kohler-Barnard, farmers are now spending billions of rands on complex security networks called farm watches.
However, there's a major trust deficit today between them and many in the police, added to which was the behavior of the police during the lockdown. A civilian touching sand with his foot was arrested and given a criminal record, while the criminals attacking members of the rural communities were not part of the COVID-19 crime prevention plan. They weren't being chased. What is happening in our rural areas is inexplicable.
South Africa's constitution defines a hate crime as motivated by prejudice or hatred regarding an aspect of a victim's identity. Given this, says former state prosecutor and now Democratic Alliance, or DA, party official Glynis Breitenbach, a good case can be made for the classification of attacks on white farmers as hate crimes, given that none of the recent attacks involved feuding neighbors or domestic violence.
Hate crimes are not simply crimes committed against vulnerable groups. Hate crimes are in fact crimes committed against individuals because of prejudice that the perpetrator holds against an entire group of people that are directed at an available victim.
Victims sometimes report that their attackers screamed racial abuse while brutalizing them. Farmer and DA agricultural official Annette Steyn says farmers don't trust South Africa's justice system, a common sentiment nationwide.
One of the issues that we have picked up with farm murders and farm attacks is that, like in other cases, sometimes cases take up to 7 to 10 years to actually get being dealt with in courts.
From now on, says Steyn, her party will dedicate teams to track investigations and court proceedings to try to make sure that victims get justice. She says it'll also pressure the state to fund new research on why farm attacks are so violent and if some of them are driven by racial hatred.
There is presently only limited and outdated research on farm attacks at both the government and academic level.
As a farmer herself, says Steyn, she wants President Cyril Ramaphosa to recognize the important role that people like her have in keeping the nation fed, and that because of this, farmers do indeed deserve special protection, whatever the color of their skin. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Soccer fans in Cameroon voiced disappointment after the government announced yesterday it would not host the finals of the 2020 African Championship League in September. The government cites the risk posed by COVID-19. Some fans say they understand, while others question if the infection is the real reason. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Mbombo Njoya, president of Cameroon's Football Association, FECAFOOT, says a recent spike in COVID-19 made the government decide not to host the continental event. The disease is caused by the coronavirus.
I have informed CAF that the government has not accepted to host the semi-final and the final of the Champions League because of the evolution of the pandemic of COVID-19. I have to recognize that it's a very reasonable decision that the government has taken. I approve it 100% because health is something which matters and you don't play with that.
Authorities in Cameroon have recorded more than 16,000 cases of the disease, which has killed at least 371 people. Cameroon-based Africa Sports analyst Jeff Ngwa says the decision will stop the spread of the coronavirus among football players, supporters, and the millions of fans who would want to be present.
Everything is uncertain when it comes to games with spectators, which means there's a risk. And I think Cameroon measured the risk with the pandemic, so Cameroon cannot be sanctioned, especially when the arguments are against a pandemic like COVID-19.
The Champions League semifinals will see two Egyptian teams, Al Ahly and Zamalek, take on Moroccan counterparts, Wydad Casablanca and Raja. In May, the Confederation of African Football said the games would be played at the recently constructed 50,000-seat Japoma Stadium in the Cameroonian seaside town of Douala. The CAF noted the stadium needed some finishing touches. On June 30, a CAF executive meeting rescheduled Africa's most prestigious final for September. Now, it is not clear when and where the games will be held. Football fan Henry Eto says Cameroon has deprived its youth from watching one of the best soccer events in the continent.
Ils n'ont pas tenu compte de l'immense majorité des Camerounais qui aiment tellement le football.
He says Cameroon has not completed infrastructure on the stadium to host the finals of the African Champions League and is now hiding behind the coronavirus to stop the competition. He says the government should have taken into consideration the wishes of a majority of Cameroonians who want to see the continent resume its soccer, as is the case in Europe. Analysts say the Confederation of African Football may turn to Morocco or Tunisia to host the competition, but that it may not be an easy decision considering the ravages of COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Media reports have sparked controversy in the Gambia by suggesting that President Adama Barrow's National People's Party, NPP, will likely merge with former dictator Jammeh's Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction Party, APRC. The privately owned Standard newspaper broke the story yesterday, and both the NPP and the APRC are among those reacting. Jammeh has been accused of widespread human rights violations during his 22 years autocratic rule. Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The report of the political merger hasn't gone down well with some Gambians in the diaspora. The Standard reported that talks between the two parties are aimed at forming an alliance in the 2021 presidential election. Duduja, the APRC deputy spokesperson, was quoted in the Standard about the possible alliance, but says the headline was incorrect in stating APRC confirms coalition talks with NPP.
It has never been tabled at our executive meetings to discuss about it, to agree or disagree. They engage one or two people, discuss about them, but those discussions have never been tabled in any executive meeting. You know, in other words, the executive of the APRC have never discussed it to agree or to disagree. But you can engage anybody, you discuss with them, there's no problem with that.
Just says he doesn't see the merger happening because the NPP would first have to respect the UN agreement that was reached for Jammeh's return to the country to be guaranteed. He also wants Jammeh's seized assets and the APRC seized assets be returned.
There must be a massive reshuffle in cabinet, not to employ or to take APRC people, but bring in competent Gambians that will serve the interests of this country. Secondly, there was a joint declaration between the AU, United Nations, and ECOWAS, which they did on behalf of the Gambia government. For them, they throw it to the dustbin. I cannot back or empower a government that does not respect agreements.
Jah also says no one can stop Jammeh from returning to the Gambia.
I feel it is Jammeh who is not settled yet to come home, but I believe there is nothing that can stop him from coming home. People allege many things against him. I said that is for the courts to decide. If the government feels he has certain allegations to prove himself right, the courts has to handle that and they will decide whether he's guilty or not.
Mamadou Coulibaly, a supporter of the United Democratic Party, took to Facebook to denounce the Barrow government, calling it one of the most dangerous ever in the Gambia.
As responsible Gambians, it is very important that when we see these things, that we come out and, you know, really express our concerns. Because ever since this government have taken over, Gambians have felt disappointed. And little did I know that we were going to wake up to a standard newspaper, you know, article, front page, saying that Barrow is in negotiations with the APRC. Now, whether true or not, it is something that obviously is brewing out there. People have heard it, people have said it, and now the newspapers are reporting it, but they're not coming out to refute it.
Sehu Mbalo is the deputy youth advisor to Barrow.
I can comfortably tell you that there is no negotiation right now between the APRC and the NPP party in regards to forming a merger. What is happening right now is the supporters of APRC are expressing their desire to give support to His Excellency the President Adama Barrow because of the reconciliation move that he is taking to make sure that Gambians are united.
Despite his denial of the possible merger, Mbalo tells VOA that he doesn't see any problem with the two parties taking such action.
To me personally, it is not a big problem forming a merger with APRC supporters. These are Gambian citizens. The right that I have, that's the same right these supporters have. They were not involved in any form of human rights violation. That, I mean the party, the membership. I'm not talking about the security. Here, when we talk about the APRC, we are talking about the party.
Mbalo says Barrow's focus is on uniting Gambians, nurturing the country's democratic process, and improving living conditions. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The group Nigerians in Diaspora Commission says it has brought home 4,180 Nigerians stranded in more than 15 countries since the COVID-19 pandemic began. Mike Mbonye reports from Lagos.
Dr. Sule Basi is the secretary to the commission, which is responsible for ensuring the engagement of Nigerians in the diaspora in the policies, projects, and participation in the development of their native country. This has included help those who were stranded by COVID-19 lockdowns.
We have brought back 4,180 Nigerians who were stranded in various countries globally. To date, we've brought these numbers from Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, South Africa, the United States of America, China, France, Italy, Egypt, Turkey, India, Sudan, Senegal, Pakistan, Germany, and many other African countries.
Basi says the returnees are made to show a certificate showing they are free of the coronavirus before boarding the flight home. He says the certificate must meet the protocols of the Nigeria Center for Disease Control and Presidential Task Force on COVID-19. He says on arrival, the returnees are checked and quarantined for 14 days before being allowed to reunite with their families. Basi says the commission is expecting more returnees soon.
On the 13th of July 2020, we are expecting the next flight from the United Kingdom. And also on the 17th and 28th of July 2020, we are expecting the third and fourth batches from the United States of America.
The secretary says the Nigerian Ministry of Foreign Affairs funds the flights and the commission provides assistance to the returnees on arrival.
All the logistics for arranging this flight are being funded by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But on our part, as Lincoln, we usually give packs of bottled water and other consumables to returnees.
Basi says the returnees undergo final testing after 14 days in quarantine and are allowed to go home if they test negative. This is Mike Mbonyi for VOA News in Lagos.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehigi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Bogbilia Baro, thanks for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.